Burns had told Truman privately that he wished to resign, pleading health problems. But Truman had asked him to stay on at least until the end of the year. Confidentially, through General Eisenhower, Truman informed George Marshall in China that he wanted him to become the next Secretary of State once Burns departed. Senator Vandenberg, who was part of the American delegation in Paris, came home to report appalling disagreement over Germany and intense suspicions between Russia and the West. There were worries over Russia, worries over Europe, worries over China. In France and Italy, the communists were emerging as the strongest single political units. In China, the Red Armies of Mao Zedong were making steady gains against the nationalist government forces of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. To a group of editors and executives from the McGraw-Hill Publishing Company who met with him informally in his office, Truman conceded that the difficulties with China were very, very bad. He was even having troubles back home in Jackson County. Infuriated by a congressman from his own district, Democrat Roger C. Slaughter, who, as a member of the House Rules Committee, had been stalling progress on the Fair Employment Practices Bill, Truman decided not to support him for re-election, and made a show of bringing Jim Pendergast to the White House to talk about it. "If Mr. Slaughter is right, I'm wrong," Truman told reporters. He had Pendergast back another candidate in the primary, Enos Axtell, with the result that some in the old Kansas City organization began resorting to their former ways, causing a storm of outrage in the Kansas City Star. When Truman returned to Independence the first week in August to vote in the primary, he discovered that the Star had a reporter staked out with binoculars, keeping watch on 219 North Delaware, to record his every move. Seeing the reporter early the next day, Truman made a point of telling him in detail exactly how he had spent the morning thus far, including certain acts performed in the bathroom. Axtell's victory in the primary was hailed by Bob Hannigan as a vote of confidence for the president. Reporters in Kansas City, however, turned up evidence of vote fraud. And though three federal judges found only minor violations in the election, Truman's involvement looked none too good, reviving old stories of his own past connection to the Pendergast machine, not to say doubts about his sense of propriety. Clark Clifford remembered it as a summer of wallowing. Even the president's health declined. He suffered from an ear infection and a return of stomach pains such as he had not had in years, the result, said Wallace Graham, of a nervous condition. "Obviously he needs a rest from the strain he's under," noted Charlie Ross in his diary, "though he looks the picture of health." "Had the most awful day I've ever had Tuesday," Truman wrote to his mother and sister on July 31st. "Saw somebody every 15 minutes on a different subject, held a cabinet luncheon and spent 2 solid hours discussing Palestine and got nowhere. Today's been almost as bad, but not quite. Got in a swim for the first time since February." He was distressed about his mother's failing health. "She's on the way out," he wrote to Bess. "It can't be helped. She's a trial to Mary, and that can't be helped either." He wished Bess would be more patient with them. Bess and Margaret remained in Independence, Bess looking after her own mother, Margaret working with a voice teacher from Kansas City. "Be good and be tough," she advised her father at the close of one chatty, affectionate letter. "I still have a number of bills staring me in the face," Truman wrote to Bess on August 10th. "Burns called me from Paris this morning, asking me not to veto a State Department reorganization bill which I'd told Clark Clifford I was sure is a striped pants boy's bill to sidetrack the Secretary of State. Jimmy told me it wasn't, but I'm still not sure. I have another one under consideration, which restores civil and military rights to a captain in the Quartermaster Department. He was court-martialed in 1926 in Panama for some 7 or 8 charges under the 93rd and 96th Articles of War. Dick Duncan, a federal district judge in Missouri and former congressman, is interested because the fellow's from St. Joe, and he put the bill through the House, and I put it through the Senate on 2 occasions, and Roosevelt vetoed it both times. When I read the record, I'm not so sure Roosevelt wasn't right. Ain't it awful what a difference it makes where you sit? I gave the whole thing to Clifford and told him to give me a cold-blooded report on it. I have another one, which is a pain in the neck. Hayden, Senator Carl Hayden, my good friend, and Congressman Cecil Rhodes King want it signed. Clinton Anderson wants it disapproved, and it looks like Anderson is right. It sure is hell to be president. Longing for a vacation, eager to get away from both Washington and independence, he had thought first of going to Alaska. He had always wanted to see Alaska, but decided instead on a cruise on the Williamsburg to New England in August, and invited his old friend and best man, Ted Marks, to join an all-male party that included Snyder, Ross, Clifford, Vaughn, George Allen, Matt Connolly, and Colonel Graham. Enough for an 8-handed game of poker. Truman loved the Williamsburg. "It's just wonderful," he often told its commander, Donald J. McDonald. "In 10 minutes I'm away from everything." He loved cruising on the river in placid waters, the green Virginia shoreline slipping by, other boats passing. "When he wasn't napping or playing cards," McDonald remembered years later, "President Truman was often up on the bridge with us, or sitting on deck. Boats would come alongside and people waved to him, which he seemed to enjoy. The boaters were just thrilled to see him. It was a different time, and no one thought of taking a potshot at him. In fact, I think the Secret Service thoroughly enjoyed whenever he went on the Williamsburg, because he became my responsibility. They just went along for the ride. I think often of this." The first few days, Truman gave up shaving and dipped into Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s The Age of Jackson. But the poker and the comradeship were, as so often, what he obviously liked best and needed most. Getting together with his old friends, with whom he was completely comfortable, was the greatest relaxation he had, remembered Clifford. See, he had no airs. He never put on airs of any kind. He was much more relaxed with them. He didn't have to be careful with them. And if he wanted to have a couple of drinks, why, he felt perfectly at ease. Nobody ever did it to excess, but that was part of the relaxation. And some of the jokes would be of the type that would not have been told in the White House, and they'd be awfully funny. And perhaps Missouri rural jokes of one kind. And then he had a wonderfully expansive, expressive laugh. They were important, such times on the Williamsburg, more important than most people might know, because he felt the strains very, very much. He liked to pretend a little that he didn't. He'd say, "Oh, I sleep fine at night." Asked once by a reporter what his attitude was toward card games, Truman replied with a twinkle in his eye, "Card games? The only game I know anything about is that game, let me see, I don't know what the name is, but you put one card down on the table and 4 face up, and you bet." His enjoyment of poker came mainly from the companionship it provided. He was considered a fairly good player, but by no means exceptional. He was what was called a loose player, rarely staying out of a pot and often betting freely with an occasional bluff. He was full of mischief at the table. Dealing left-handed, he loved to taunt anyone needing a particular card. Sometimes, after taking a poll of what the others wanted to play, he would deal something else. He liked games with wild cards, and especially a version of ordinary stud poker that he called Papa Vinson, after Fred Vinson, who was a particularly skillful player. "He always plays a close hand, I'll say that," Ted Marks remembered. "You can tell when he's winning because there's a kind of smile on his face." As Truman himself conceded, poker was by far his favorite relaxation. "My favorite form of paperwork." It took his mind off other things more than anything else. It made no difference to him if the stakes were nickels and dimes, and no apparent difference to his enjoyment of the game if he won or lost. Wallace Graham thought the president played poker as much for what it revealed about the other players at the table as for the pleasure of the game itself. The fact that Vinson, for example, was an expert player was not incidental to Truman's high regard for Vinson. Clifford, who had played little until coming to the White House, but had bought a book on the game and studied assiduously, would remember that on this and other trips on the yacht, poker, except for meals, took up the better part of most days, but that lunch often lasted 2 hours or more because of all the talk, Truman obviously enjoying every moment and contributing more than his share. I will bet that the subject of his selection as Roosevelt's running mate in Chicago must have come up 40 times, all the different facets about it. The president's drinking, widespread stories notwithstanding, was moderate. Some mornings on deck he might squint at the sky and comment that it must be noon somewhere in the world and ask for a bourbon. On occasion he would show the effects of several drinks, expressing himself, as Clifford later wrote, in language less restrained and more colorful than he would otherwise use, and especially if he had had a particularly vexing week. But he could also nurse a single drink through a whole evening of talk and poker. "The Williamsburg, being a commissioned vessel, was not supposed to serve liquor," recalled MacDonald. "But as commander-in-chief, it was, of course, Truman's prerogative to drink on board if he so wished. I made no issue of that. Old Granddad was his favorite." When, at Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, they hit cold winds, rain, and fog, Truman ordered a change in plans. They turned and headed south to Bermuda, which he knew had been Woodrow Wilson's favorite retreat, and where finally, in ideal weather, he enjoyed a few days of peace and uninterrupted sunshine. "This is a paradise you dream about but hardly ever see," he wrote to Margaret on August 23rd. But in Hampton Roads, on the return to Washington, they sailed straight into a storm. The 244-foot Williamsburg, built in 1930 as a private yacht and purchased by the Navy at the outset of the war, had never been a particularly good seagoing vessel, even after several hundred tons of pig iron were put down in the bilges to improve stability. Now the ship did all sorts of antics, as Truman would tell his mother. Violently ill, he took to his bed. "The furniture was taking headers in every direction," he told Bess, "and it was necessary to stay in bed to keep your legs on." His stateroom was a shambles. Papers, books, chairs, clothing, yours, Margaret's, and Mama's pictures mixed up with Time, Newsweek, Reader's Digest, Collier's, Saturday Evening Post, luggage, pillows, looked as if it never would be in shape again. The summer heat of Washington held, and again he was alone in the Great White Jail, as he had begun calling the White House. Some of the servants had been telling him how the ghost of Abraham Lincoln had appeared over the years. Truman became convinced the house was haunted. "Night before last," he reported to Bess, "I went to bed at 9 o'clock after shutting my doors. At 4 o'clock I was awakened by 3 distinct knocks on my bedroom door. I jumped up and put on my bathrobe, opened the door, and no one there. Went out, looked up and down the hall, looked into your room and Margie's, still no one. Went back to bed after locking the doors, and there were footsteps in your room whose door I'd left open. Jumped up and looked, and no one there. Damn place is haunted sure as shootin'. Secret Service said not even a watchman was up here at that hour. More and more he disliked living there. Better it be made a museum, he thought, and give the president a rent allowance. That way, he told Bess, they could move back to the apartment on Connecticut Avenue, an idea he knew she would welcome. You better lock your door and prop up some chairs, and next time you hear knocks, don't answer, Margaret advised him. It'll probably be A. Jackson in person. The little oak-paneled elevator that had carried him to the second floor the afternoon of Franklin Roosevelt's death was being replaced with new equipment. The old elevator, dating from Theodore Roosevelt's day, had moved too slowly for Truman, and on one occasion broke down, leaving him stranded between floors. He had to ring a gong and wait for the workmen to hurry to the basement and jiggle the apparatus back into motion. New chandeliers were being installed, his bathtub fitted with a glass shower stall. But he had little faith in the old house. The stock market was falling. A maritime strike that had begun on the West Coast was rapidly spreading. Next thing, he thought, the White House roof would cave in. "I'm in the middle, no matter what happens," he wrote mournfully the second week of September, on the eve of the Wallace fiasco. At a press conference in his office the afternoon of Thursday, September 12th, the president was asked by a reporter to comment on a speech scheduled to be given by the Secretary of Commerce at a political rally in New York at Madison Square Garden that evening, copies of which had already been distributed to the press. Truman said he couldn't answer questions about a speech that had not yet been delivered, at which Charlie Ross and others of the staff standing by appeared to breathe a sigh of relief. "If the president had only stopped there," Ross later wrote. The reporter, William Mylander of the Coles newspapers, pressed on, saying Secretary Wallace referred in the speech to the president himself, which was why he had asked. There was laughter, and Truman good-naturedly said that being the case, perhaps he should hear the question. Mylander, who held a copy of the speech in his hand, said it contained a sentence asserting that the president had read these words and that they represented administration policy. That was correct, said Truman. Was he endorsing a particular paragraph or the whole speech? He had approved the whole speech, Truman said breezily. Reporters looked at one another. Mr. President, asked Raymond Brandt of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, do you regard Wallace's speech a departure from Burns's policy? I do not, Truman snapped back before Brandt could finish his sentence, toward Russia. They are exactly in line, said Truman, in a manner implying the question was frivolous and that he wished reporters would ask something harder. In truth, he hadn't read all the speech, or hadn't been paying attention when Wallace went over it with him, and had given it no thought since. The president, noted Charlie Ross in his diary, had now been betrayed by his own amiability. According to Wallace's diary account, he and Truman had run through the speech together page by page, and Truman agreed with everything in it. He didn't have a single change to suggest, Wallace wrote. Clark Clifford, too, would remember Wallace reading through the speech for the president. But Truman, in his own diary, said he had been able to give Wallace only 10 or 15 minutes, most of which had been taken up with other matters. He had tried to skim through it, Truman wrote, assuming that Wallace was cooperating in all phases of administration policy, including foreign policy. One paragraph caught my eye. It said that we held no special friendship for Russia, Britain, or any other country, that we wanted to see all the world at peace on an equal basis. I said that is, of course, what we want. It was on the basis of this single paragraph only, according to Truman, that he gave his approval, trusting to Henry to play square with me. In private conversation with Charlie Ross, he also admitted that he had looked at only parts of the speech, relying on Wallace's assurance that the rest was all right. And most of the speech was, indeed, in line with administration policy. Wallace urged support for the United Nations, called for increased international trade and international control of atomic weapons. But he also condemned British imperialism and appeared to be advocating American and Russian spheres of interest in the world, a concept strongly opposed by Burns. The United States, Wallace said, had no more business in the political affairs of Eastern Europe than Russia has in the political affairs of Latin America. Any get-tough policy was foolhardy. Get-tough never brought anything real and lasting, whether for schoolyard bullies or businessmen or world power, Wallace said. The tougher we get, the tougher the Russians will get. At Madison Square Garden, departing from his prepared text, Wallace told an audience of 20,000, an audience in part vociferously pro-Soviet, "I realize that the danger of war is much less from communism than it is from imperialism." As James Reston wrote in the New York Times the following day, Truman appeared to be the only person in Washington who saw no difference between what Wallace had said and his own policy, or that of his Secretary of State in Paris, who reportedly was outraged. An angry Arthur Vandenberg declared there could be only one Secretary of State at a time. Saturday morning, the 14th, his immediate staff gathered about his desk, Truman openly berated himself for having made so grave a blunder. At a press conference that afternoon, he read a carefully prepared statement, and this time no questions were permitted. "There had been a natural misunderstanding," Truman said. His answer to Mr. Mylander's question had not conveyed the thought intended. It had been his wish only to express approval of Secretary Wallace's right to deliver the speech, Truman insisted, not approval of the speech itself. Having stumbled into trouble, he was clumsily and obviously fabricating in a desperate effort to get himself out and get Burns off the hook in Paris. "There has been no change in the established foreign policy of our country," he also said, which was true but did no good. "The criticism continued to mount," wrote Ross, who had helped prepare the statement. Dispatches from Paris indicated that Burns and his delegation felt that something more needed to be done. And indeed, they were right. The question still remained whether Wallace was to be allowed to go on attacking in public the foreign policy line laid down by Burns at Paris. The press secretary's seat became warmer and warmer. I could only reply to questions that the president and Burns were not in communication. The Wallace episode boiled on for days. As Wallace continued to tell reporters that he stood by his speech, Truman kept to a light schedule, saying nothing further for attribution. Then Ross, too, blundered badly. Hearing that columnist Drew Pearson had obtained a long private letter written by Wallace to Truman 2 months earlier, a letter apparently leaked to Pearson by someone in the State Department, Ross, without approval from Truman, agreed with Wallace that the letter should be released to the press in order to deny Pearson the limelight. When Ross informed the president of what he had done, Truman told him to call Wallace at once and stop release of the letter. But by then it was too late. The letter was out. Dated July 23rd, it consisted of 12 single-spaced typed pages, more critical even of administration policy than Wallace's speech had been. Forcefully advocating a new approach to the Soviet Union, Wallace charged, among other things, that certain unnamed members of the U.S. military command advocated a preventive war before Russia had time to develop an atomic bomb. "I'm still having Henry Wallace trouble, and it grows worse as we go along," Truman confided plaintively to his mother on Wednesday, September 18th. Wallace was expected momentarily at the White House. "I think he'll quit today, and I won't shed any tears. Never was there such a mess, and it is partly my making. But when I make a mistake, it is a good one." To Wallace, too, Truman said he had only himself to blame for most of what had happened. He had not known so many sleepless nights since the convention at Chicago. They talked alone in the Oval Office, Wallace giving no sign that he intended to quit. His mail, Wallace said, was running 5-1 in favor of his New York speech. "The people are afraid that the get-tough-with-Russia policy is leading us to war," Wallace told him. "You yourself, as Harry Truman, really believed in my speech." He advised Truman to be far to the left when Congress was not in session, then move to the right when Congress returned. That was the Roosevelt technique, Wallace said. Roosevelt had never let his right hand know what his left hand was up to. "Henry told me during our conversation that as president I couldn't play square," Truman would report to Bess, "that anything was justified so long as we stayed in power." If Truman would only lean more in his direction, Wallace said, it could mean victory for the Democrats in Congress in November. Truman told him he thought the Congress would go Republican in any event. He asked Wallace to stop making foreign policy speeches, or to agree to the policy for which I am responsible. But Wallace would not agree. Still, Truman refused to fire him. Indeed, he hardly dared offend him. As the last surviving New Dealer in the cabinet, Wallace was too important symbolically. As Wallace knew, and as Wallace knew, Truman knew. For countless liberal Democrats, Wallace remained the rightful heir to the Roosevelt succession, while Truman was only a usurper. For Truman to have an open break with Wallace, anything like the Ickes affair, could be politically disastrous. The only agreement reached at last, after 2.5 hours of talk, was that Wallace would say no more on foreign policy at least until Burns came home. In the lobby afterward, when reporters asked if everything had been straightened out, Wallace replied, "Everything's lovely." "Henry is the most peculiar fellow I ever came in contact with," Truman informed his mother. In his diary, he was more explicit. Wallace was unsound intellectually and 100% pacifist. "He wants to disband our armed forces, give Russia our atomic bomb secrets, and trust a bunch of adventurers in the Kremlin Politburo. I do not understand a dreamer like that. The Reds, Phonies, and Parlor Pinks seem to be banded together and are becoming a national danger. I am afraid they are a sabotage front for Uncle Joe Stalin. They can see no wrong in Russia's 4.5 million armed force, in Russia's loot of Poland, Austria, Hungary, Romania, Manchuria. They can see no wrong in Russia's living off the occupied countries to support the military occupation." At the Pentagon, at Truman's request, Secretaries Patterson and Forrestal issued a joint statement denying they knew of any responsible Army or Navy officer who had ever advocated or even suggested a policy or plan of attacking Russia. From Paris, Burns sent Truman a long, reasoned message asking to be relieved at once. "When the administration is divided on its own foreign policy, it cannot hope to convince the world that the American people have a foreign policy. I do not want to ask you to do anything that would force Mr. Wallace out of the cabinet. However, I do not think any man who professes any loyalty to you would so seriously impair your prestige and the prestige of the government with the nations of the world. You and I spent 15 months building a bipartisan policy. We did a fine job convincing the world that it was a permanent policy upon which the world could rely. Wallace destroyed it in a day." At 9:30, the morning of Friday, September 20th, Truman called Wallace on the phone and fired him. And, as Truman confided to Bess, "Wallace was so nice about it, I almost backed out." Then he added, "I just don't understand the man, and he doesn't either." Further, Wallace offered to return an angry, longhand letter, not abusive, but on a low level, as Wallace described it, that Truman had sent him the night before. "You don't want this thing out," Wallace told Truman, and Truman gratefully agreed. He was very happy to take it back. Later, Wallace crossed the street from his office and posed for photographers sitting peacefully on a park bench reading the comic papers. When, at a crowded, hurriedly called press conference in his office, Truman made the announcement, there were audible gasps from reporters and one long, low whistle. Once the room was cleared, Truman sat down at his desk and, turning to Ross, who was standing nearby, said, "Well, the die is cast." He had shown, Ross told him, that he would rather be right than president. "I would rather be anything than president," Truman said. "No man in his right mind would want to come here to the White House of his own accord," he had written earlier to Margaret. Now, wishing, as always, to shine untarnished in her eyes, he tried to excuse his handling of the Wallace affair by saying he had no gift for duplicity. "To be a good president," he told her, "one had to be a combination Machiavelli, Louis XI of France, Cesare Borgia, and Talleyrand. A liar, double-crosser, and unctuous religio, Richelieu, hero and whatnot. And he didn't have the stomach for it. Thanks be to God." He was mulling history and his own life more and more. On September 26th, anniversary of the start of the Argonne Offensive of 1918, reflecting on the intervening years, he wrote in his diary as follows, referring to himself only as a serviceman of my acquaintance. The rage that filled his earlier rail strike speech was absent now, replaced by a kind of melancholy and disappointment and an underlying resolve to face whatever he must. September 26th, 1918, a few minutes before 4 a.m., a serviceman of my acquaintance was standing behind a battery of French 75s at a little town called Neuville to the right of the Argonne Forest. A barrage was to be fired by all the guns on the Allied front from Belgium to the Swiss border. At 4 a.m., that barrage started. At 5 a.m., the infantry in front of my acquaintance's battery went over. At 8 a.m., the artillery, including the 75 battery referred to, moved forward. That forward movement did not stop until November 11th, 1918. My acquaintance came home, was banqueted and treated as returned soldiers are usually treated by the home people immediately after the tension of war is relieved. The home people forgot the war. 2 years later, turned out the administration which had successfully conducted our part of the war and turned the clock back. They began to talk of disarmament. They did disarm themselves, to the point of helplessness. They became fat and rich. Special privilege ran the country, ran it to a fall. In 1932, a great leader came forward and rescued the country from chaos and restored the confidence of the people in their government and their institutions. Then another European war came along. We tried, as before, to keep out of it. We refused to believe that we could get into it. The great leader warned the country of the possibility. He was vilified, smeared, misrepresented, but kept his courage. As was inevitable, we were forced into the war. The country awoke. Late, but it awoke and created the greatest war production program in history under the great leader. The country furnished Russia, Britain, China, Australia, and all the Allies guns, tanks, planes, food in unheard-of quantities, built, manned, and fought the greatest navy in history, created the most powerful and efficient air force ever heard of, and equipped an army of 8.5 million men and fought them on two fronts 12,000 miles apart and from 3,000 to 7,000 miles from the home base, created the greatest merchant marine in history in order to maintain those two battlefronts. The collapse of the enemies of liberty came almost simultaneously in May for the Eastern Front and in August for the Western Front. Unfortunately, the great leader who had taken the nation through the peacetime and wartime emergencies passed to his great reward just 1 month before the German surrender. What a pity for this to happen after 12 long years of the hardest kind of work, 3.5 of them in the most terrible of all wars. My acquaintance, who commanded the 75 Battery of September 26, 1918, took over. The same elation filled the home people as filled them after the First World War. They were happy to have the fighting stop and to quit worrying about their sons and daughters in the armed forces. Then the reaction set in. Selfishness, greed, jealousy raised their ugly heads. No wartime incentive to keep them down. Labor began to grab all it could get by fair means or foul. Farmers began black marketing food. Industry hoarded inventories, and the same old pacifists began to talk disarmament. But my acquaintance tried to meet every situation and has met them up to now. Can he continue to outface the demagogues, the chiselers, the jealousies? Time only will tell. The human animal and his emotions change not much from age to age. He must change now, or he faces absolute and complete destruction, and maybe the insect age, or an atmosphereless planet, will succeed him. Section 5. Harold Ickes called him stupid. If the world had to depend on Truman and his administration to keep it out of trouble, wrote Time, then the world had much to worry about. Not in 80 years, not since Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, had a president been the target of such abuse. He was made fun of for his mid-American mannerisms, his Missouri pals, the by now famous devotion to his mother. Every day is Mother's Day in the White House, it was said with a snicker. According to one of the latest Washington jokes in the autumn of 1946, Truman was late for a cabinet meeting because he woke up stiff in the joints from trying to put his foot in his mouth. A joke from Texas began with reflections on how Roosevelt might have handled the country's problems, then ended with the line, "I wonder what Truman would do if he were alive." A Chicago Sun cartoon that was reprinted widely showed him pop-eyed and befuddled, one hand on his aching head asking, "What next?" In Boston, the Henry M. Frost Advertising Agency came up with an inspired two-word campaign slogan for the Republicans. Had enough? Truman's popularity had vanished. Poll results released the first week in October, a month before the congressional elections, showed only 40% of the country approved his performance. On the eve of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, in what struck many as a bald play for the Jewish vote in New York, he called for admitting 100,000 Jewish refugees to the British protectorate in Palestine. But the fact was, he had already made the same statement months before. And Republican Thomas E. Dewey, who was running for re-election as governor of New York, now quickly outbid him for Jewish support by demanding that several hundred thousand Jews be permitted to migrate to Palestine. In another few weeks, Truman's standing in the polls plunged to a low of 32%, nearly 50 points below where it had been the year before. The depression that everyone had so feared had not come. Employment, even with all the strikes, was high. Money was plentiful. Business was booming. But the cost of living had also leaped 6.5 points just since the end of 1945, and there were still acute shortages of the things people most wanted. Housing, automobiles, refrigerators, nylon stockings, sugar, coffee, and, increasingly, meat. Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn, fearing a Democratic debacle at the polls, complained to a friend, "This is going to be a damned beefsteak election." As November drew closer and the meat shortage grew worse, the Republicans capitalized on a made-to-order issue. Cattle raisers staged a strike, refusing to send cattle to market. "Nothing on meat, Mr. President?" Truman was asked by reporters on October 10th. "Nothing on meat," he said. Democratic Party Chairman Bob Hannigan warned Truman that if controls on meat prices were not dropped, he could expect a Republican sweep. Truman told his staff he was sure to be damned whatever he did. If he ended controls, he would be accused of caving into pressure. If he left things as they were, he would continue to be seen as cause of all the trouble. Talk of his Pendergast connection was encouraged as Republicans stepped up the heat. He became, again, the little machine hack from Backwater, Missouri. New York showman Billy Rose suggested W.C. Fields for president in 1948, saying, "If we're going to have a comedian in the White House, let's have a good one." The chairman of the Republican National Committee, Congressman Carol Reese of Tennessee, declared nothing remained of the Democratic Party but three distasteful elements: Southern racists, big city bosses, and radicals bent on Sovietizing the country. Discontent over meat shortages was one thing. Fear of communist influence and infiltration was quite another, and in the long run far more important. A Red Scare was clearly on the rise. Edward T. Folliard of the Washington Post found hatred of communism rampant everywhere he traveled. Harry Truman, the Republicans charged, was pursuing a policy of appeasing the Russians abroad and fostering communism at home. The Democratic Party, said Senator Taft, was so divided between communism and Americanism that its foreign policy can only be futile and contradictory and make the United States the laughingstock of the world. John Tabor, a Republican congressman from Auburn, New York, who had a voice like a bullhorn, warned of communist infiltration of the universities, even the army. While in California, another Republican congressional candidate, young Richard M. Nixon, castigated high officials who front for un-American elements wittingly or otherwise. Yet, such attacks were hardly different in spirit from Truman's own private anxieties over Reds and Parlor Pinks. And who could say, after the uncovering of the Ottawa spy ring, that there was no cause for alarm? That summer, under pressure from Attorney General Clark, Truman had secretly agreed to continuation of electronic surveillance in cases where the national defense was involved, a policy instituted by Roosevelt, although, as Clark neglected to tell Truman, Roosevelt's original authorization in 1940 had been limited to aliens only. In a speech at San Francisco, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI warned that no less than 100,000 communists were loose in the country. The shrill pitch of abuse heaped upon the president continued to echo, wrote Time. So mild a man as Harry Truman might well wonder at the temper of his countrymen. Democrats were filled with despair. Bob Hannigan advised Truman that it would be best if he made no campaign appearances or political speeches, a decision Truman accepted. He kept to the White House. For days, for a portrait by Frank O. Salisbury, the British artist who had done Roosevelt, Truman posed in Charlie Ross's office, where three windows provided ample north light. On the afternoon the Supreme Court was to make its traditional White House call, he was listening to the deciding game of the 1946 World Series, the St. Louis Cardinals versus the Boston Red Sox, when a staff aide told him the justices would soon be arriving in formal attire. Truman hurried upstairs and changed into striped trousers and a swallowtail coat, only to find at the reception that he alone was formally dressed. Few campaigning Democrats even so much as mentioned the president's name. In some congressional contests, Democratic candidates resorted to playing old recordings of Roosevelt speeches to boost their chances. Senator Harley Kilgore, a warm friend and admirer of Truman, who was running for re-election in West Virginia, found that in the back hollows and coal fields, the mere mention of Truman's name brought a chorus of boos and catcalls. "Here was a man who was actually doing an excellent job," Kilgore would recall. "But the most you could do was to defend him in a humorous fashion by using the old Western saloon refrain, 'Don't shoot our piano player, he's doing the best he can.'" The capacity to smile when in trouble is a prime requirement for a politician, as Truman, a career politician, had long understood. And now, as so often before in difficult times, he revealed no sign of anger or gloom. He never complained, never acted sorry for himself, or blamed others. He was as cheerful and optimistic, as interested in others, as pleased to see them and to be with them as ever. As Alonzo Fields, who saw him daily and close up as only a butler could, later wrote of Truman, he never seemed to have a problem, at this or any other time when worries beset him. "I am sure no one in the household could tell when he was troubled." On October 14th, 3 weeks before the election, Truman went on the radio to announce that reluctantly he was lifting price controls on meat. On October 23rd, he flew to New York to address the General Assembly of the United Nations at Flushing Meadow. "The course of history," he said in a well-reasoned speech, "has made us one of the stronger nations of the world. It has therefore placed upon us special responsibilities to conserve our strength and to use it rightly in a world so interdependent as our world today." Even the Russians complimented him. "We went to the Waldorf afterward," he wrote Margaret. "Your ma put on her best bib and tucker, and we went down to the ballroom for a reception. shook hands with 835 people in 1 hour flat. Still, he kept silent on politics. Traveling home by train to Independence to vote, he was greeted at Jefferson City by a crowd of cheering schoolchildren who set up a chant. "Make a 2-hour speech, make it a full holiday." But Truman, all smiles, only waved and shook his head, then clamped one hand over his mouth. The Republicans swept the election, carrying both houses of Congress for the first time since before the Depression, an era so distant to most people that it seemed another world. The margin in the House was 246 Republicans to 188 Democrats. In the Senate, 51 to 45. The Republicans took a majority of the state governorships as well, including New York, where Thomas E. Dewey was re-elected by the largest margin ever recorded. In one city after another, Chicago, Detroit, Jersey City, New York, Democratic machines went down to defeat. In Kansas City, Truman's own hand-picked candidate for Congress, Enos Axtell, lost to his Republican opponent by 6,000 votes, which Margaret Truman remembered as mortifying for her father. The Chicago Tribune hailed the Republican triumph as the greatest victory for the country since Appomattox. The New Deal had been finally put to flight, the grip of the Democrats in Washington broken at last. Harry Truman, the accidental president, was now also a minority president. A young Democratic congressman from Arkansas, J. William Fulbright, was so distressed by the Republican landslide and the likelihood of a 2-year stalemate in Washington that he proposed Truman appoint Arthur Vandenberg Secretary of State, then resign, and thus make Vandenberg president, an idea that led Truman to refer to Fulbright thereafter as Halfbright. Truman and his family started back to Washington on Election Day without waiting for the polls to close. By arrangement, however, the election returns were to be put on board the train every 100 miles or so. That night, Charlie Ross came through the train to invite several Washington reporters to join the president in his private car for a poker game. "The game was hot and heavy until about 2 a.m., remembered Merriman Smith of United Press. The returns had been arriving in a steady stream since 9 p.m., Not once did Truman look at them, nor did he refer to the elections. At one point, Margaret interrupted to say the results from Independence had come in. Truman, glancing at the slip of paper, shook his head and smiled up at her. "Why bother with this sort of thing?" he said. "Don't worry about me. I know how things will turn out, and they'll be all right." Probably no president since Andrew Johnson had run out of prestige and leadership more thoroughly than had Harry Truman when he returned almost unnoticed to Washington on that bleak, misty November morning in 1946, wrote Cabell Phillips. At Union Station, Truman stepped from his car, silent but smiling, a book under his arm. Chapter 12. Turning Point. Truman to the Congress in 1947. "This is a serious course upon which we embark." Section 1. Was Harry Truman an ordinary provincial American sadly miscast in the presidency? Or was he a man of above-average, even exceptional, qualities and character, who had the makings of greatness? What a test of democracy if it works, Roy Roberts of the Kansas City Star had written on Truman's first day in office. Now, less than 2 years later, Walter Lippmann, like a great many others, was convinced the test had not worked. To Lippmann, regarded as the most thoughtful, authoritative political commentator of the time, Truman was an embarrassment. His bravado and quick decisions, Lippmann thought, were a facade for an essentially insecure man filled with anxieties. How could the affairs of the country be conducted by a president who not only had lost the support of his party, but was no longer in command of his administration? In the years on the farm, when courting Bess, his first campaign, Truman himself had professed to being only a common, everyday fellow. He could promise her no more. But he had written also that every farmer thinks he's as good as the president, or perhaps a little better, meaning that by the old Jeffersonian faith in which he had been raised, what was ordinary grassroots American was as good as the best. Questioned once by a reporter whether he considered himself the sublimation of the average man, Truman rejected the fancy phrase and asked in turn, "Well, what is wrong with being the average man?" Since 1945, numbers of others had judged him as anything but ordinary. At Potsdam, Churchill immediately perceived the new president to be a man of immense determination. And in the fateful spring of 1947, from Chartwell, his home south of London, where he was busy with his memoirs, Churchill would write to tell, "My dear Harry, how much he admired what you have done for the peace and freedom of the world." For Churchill, the presidency of Harry Truman had become the one cause for hope in the world. Dean Acheson, who could be extremely hard, even contemptuous, in his judgment of men he did not consider his equals, had described Truman, after Roosevelt's death, as straightforward, decisive, honest, and, if inexperienced, likely to learn fast. And in the time since, Acheson had found no reason to think differently. On the morning in November 1946, when Truman arrived at Washington's Union Station, his political stock at an all-time low, Acheson alone of all the administration was waiting on the platform to greet him, a gesture that Truman understandably never forgot. Acheson looked to Truman as a leader. "The captain with the mighty heart," Acheson would call him. Arthur Kroc of the New York Times, foremost of Washington correspondents, was another who had seen something very good and human and courageous in this unlikely president, and at a point when many political commentators were ready to write him off. Felix Belair, White House correspondent for the Times, had decided that while Truman might look as much like the average guy on the streetcar as ever, he was a man to rise to the occasion. So, testament from experienced observers that this was a president of considerable substance, and that it would be a mistake to count him out, was already plentiful, even before the great change that came in 1947. David E. Lilienthal, whom Truman had earlier reappointed head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA, was a trim, agreeable-looking man in his mid-40s, the son of Jewish immigrants, a graduate of DePauw University and the Harvard Law School, and regarded still as a model New Dealer. TVA was a huge success. It had built dams, created lakes, forests, new industries, new farming methods, brought electricity to some 700,000 users, and, during the war, fueled the giant uranium plants at Oak Ridge. and Lilienthal, as much as anyone, had made TVA. Unlike so many new dealers who had quit since Roosevelt's death, who had fled government, as Clark Clifford said, so fast they were falling all over each other, Lilienthal had chosen to stay, not once, but twice. In October, he had resigned from TVA to become Truman's designated, though still unconfirmed, head of the new Atomic Energy Commission, which Truman insisted be under civilian control. It was a position potentially as important as almost any in post-war Washington, and one for which Lilienthal felt himself inadequately qualified. But then, who was qualified? And the president had been extremely persuasive and patient while Lilienthal went through days of soul-searching. Hard-working, articulate, Lilienthal was an exceptionally able man, if by some people's standards overly liberal, and his presence in the administration, like that of Burns, Marshall, Harriman, who had returned from London to replace Henry Wallace at the Department of Commerce, Acheson, Bolin, and Clark Clifford, belied the whole idea that Truman had surrounded himself only with Missouri fools and mediocrities. Lilienthal did not entirely approve of Truman's performance thus far. As a liberal, he had been so shattered by Truman's call to draft the striking rail workers that after hearing Truman's speech over the radio, Lilienthal walked out into his garden in Tennessee and stood in a drenching rain, hoping it might wash away his misery. Still, Lilienthal had faith in Truman, faith in the man, because Truman had shown such faith in him, but also because he saw qualities of courage and candor rare in a politician. Indeed, he felt better about working for the Truman administration, Lilienthal said, than he had working for Roosevelt, because now he could get straight answers. Since November, Lilienthal had been extremely concerned about the effect so humiliating a defeat in the elections might have on Truman's self-confidence and thus on his program. Lilienthal's own appointment, as a prime example, was bound to stir up a hornet's nest once the confirmation process began on the Hill, since the aging, vituperative Senator McKellar of Tennessee, who had fought to deny Lilienthal's reappointment at TVA and despised him no less than ever, had just been reelected to another term. Not for a month after the elections did Lilienthal actually see the president, and then only by chance. It was at about 5 o'clock on an afternoon in early December, when Lilienthal and Clifford were working quietly in the cabinet room. The day was nearly over. It was growing dark outside. Clifford nudged him to look up at the French doors that opened to the outside passage to the main house. The president was standing on the other side of the glass, looking in at them and smiling. Not knowing what else to do, Lilienthal rose and bowed awkwardly. Truman waved, still smiling, then moved quickly on, a Secret Service man a half step behind. Nothing had been said. The whole incident occupied only seconds. But to Lilienthal, it was a moment of encouragement worth recording in his diary. As he would also record the hearty welcome Truman gave him a few days later in the Oval Office, when, with the four others on his new commission, Lilienthal came to make a brief progress report. The Army would relinquish no more control over atomic energy than it could possibly avoid, Truman warned. I know how they are. They are trained not to give up. I know because I am one of them. Again, he was smiling. As the meeting ended and the group wished the president luck, Truman, thanking them, replied that his luck had been improving lately, this in reference to a recent test of wills with John L. Lewis. But what impressed Lilienthal was the kind of grim gaiety in his tone and manner. The change in the president became more obvious by the day. There had been a showdown with John L. Lewis just after the November elections. At Clark Clifford's urging, Truman had challenged the legality of still another threatened coal strike, except this time it was to be a fight to the finish, as Truman said. "Oh, God, it was the chance of a lifetime," Clifford would remember. "Be right, be strong. Nobody's bigger than the President of the United States. All the signs were right. It looked like Lewis had violated the law. Roosevelt had toadied to him time and again. But now he pushed the president the wrong way. And he just said one day, 'Okay, we're going to go.'" The administration took the powerful labor boss to court on the grounds that he was violating the Smith-Connolly Act, which prohibited strikes against government-held facilities, the coal mines being still technically under government seizure. An injunction was served, and when Lewis let the strike begin on November 20th, a federal district judge ordered him to stand trial for contempt. Lewis refused. On December 4th, the judge hit the United Mine Workers with a stunning $3 million fine and fined Lewis personally $10,000. Truman, meanwhile, had been to Florida and back for a few days of vacation at the Key West Naval Base. On December 7th, Lewis gave up and ordered his men back to the mines, pending an appeal to the Supreme Court. In March 1947, the Supreme Court upheld the contempt ruling, though the fine against the union was later reduced. It was a resounding victory for the administration and another step up for Clifford. Established now in Sam Rosenman's old office, the second largest and best office in the West Wing, Clifford was only 20 paces from the president's desk and saw him 6 or 7 times a day. Often they ate together in the basement lunchroom. Truman was hugely pleased by the collapse of Lewis. For the first time in months, he was being praised by the press. "Harry S. Truman stood fast where Franklin Roosevelt met Lewis halfway," said Newsweek. And this, too, of course, he greatly enjoyed. But the real change in the view of his old friend Charlie Ross and others had come with the elections. It was the sweeping Republican triumph, ironically, that had given Truman a new lease on life, freeing him at last from the shadow of Franklin Roosevelt, as perhaps nothing else could have. He owed no one anything any longer. He was free to take charge, to be himself, and show what he could do if he had to. He was on his own again, much as he had been in the 1940 Senate race, when Tom Pendergast was out of the picture and Roosevelt had abandoned him, or as he had been on the farm when his father died, or in France in 1918, when with his new captain's bars he stood alone, trembling and speechless before his new command. The president was now a free man and can write a fine record, Ross wrote to his sister. The real Truman administration, Ross told White House reporters, began the day after the elections. And clearly Truman agreed. In a letter to Bess from Key West, he had vowed, "I'm doing as I damn please for the next 2 years and to hell with all of them." Far from being downcast or tentative about his new role as a minority president, he had returned from Florida, tanned, rested, eager to get going. He had accepted the verdict of the people in the spirit, he said, that all good citizens accept the results of any fair election. The change in Congress did not alter the country's domestic or foreign problems, and in foreign affairs especially, it must be a national and not a party program. Of course, conflicts would arise between a Republican Congress and a Democratic president. That was to be expected. But he, Harry Truman, would be guided by a simple idea: to do in all cases, without regard to political considerations, what seems to me to be for the welfare of all our people. In the new 80th Congress, Joe Martin would replace Sam Rayburn as Speaker of the House. In the Senate, instead of Alvin Barkley, Taft and Vandenberg would hold the reins of power. And with the tacit understanding that Taft would attend to domestic issues, Vandenberg to foreign affairs as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. Truman knew the three Republican leaders from years of experience. Vandenberg, whom he knew best and liked best, had been a friend since Truman's first days in the Senate, and Truman considered him both able and trustworthy. A former newspaper editor from Grand Rapids, Van had been an all-out isolationist until the war. But Pearl Harbor, he liked to say, had ended isolationism for any realist. Once in London during an attack of German robot bombs, Vandenberg remarked to a friend, "How can there be immunity or isolation when men can devise weapons like that?" It was a conversion of far-reaching consequence. Not only was Vandenberg one of the Senate's inner circle, and among Republicans the undisputed authority on foreign affairs, but he was a formidable force as a speaker. Large and hearty, he had the mannerisms of a somewhat pompous stage senator. The cigar, the florid phrase, and more than a little vanity, carefully combing a few long strands of gray hair sideways over the top of his bald head. When making a point on the Senate floor, he favored the broad gesture, grandly flinging out one arm in a sweeping arc. His prestige reached beyond national boundaries, and like Truman during his years in the Senate, he had made no enemies. Vandenberg was the son of a harness maker, Joe Martin the son of a blacksmith. Backgrounds Truman could identify with, as he could not with the privileged world of Robert A. Taft, whose father had been President William Howard Taft. Martin, who came from North Attleboro, Massachusetts, a factory town south of Boston, had arrived in Congress first in 1925, when his friend Calvin Coolidge was president. And for 42 years, Martin's outlook had remained fundamentally that of Coolidge. No legislation of importance had been attached to his name, no memorable declaration of political philosophy. But he was a good cloakroom organizer and known as dependable and fair-minded, straight as a string, as was said in the home district. A short, square man, he wore poorly fitting three-piece navy blue suits and boxy black policeman's shoes. Even when speaking to small groups at home, he would stand on a chair in order to be seen. A lock of dark hair that fell over the right side of his forehead had become a trademark. Like his Democratic counterpart, Sam Rayburn, Martin was a bachelor. He neither drank, nor smoked, nor showed much interest in anything beyond politics and the hometown newspaper he owned, the North Attleboro Chronicle. Whatever was good for the district, Joe Martin held, was pretty much good for the nation. On New Year's Day, busy placing calls to his cabinet to wish them a happy New Year, Truman decided to phone Vandenberg and Martin as well, and was encouraged by the results. Vandenberg was very pleasant, Martin even more so, assuring the president that cooperation was uppermost in his mind. "He told me that he would be most happy to talk to me any time on any subject," Truman recorded. "I am inclined to believe that he meant what he said." Taft, whom Truman did not call New Year's Day, was a remote, self-absorbed man, a cold fish in the view of many. Bob is not austere, his wife once explained. He's just departmentalized. Younger than Truman by 5 years, Taft had been born into affluent, cultivated surroundings in Cincinnati. He had stood first in his class at Yale and later at the Harvard Law School. Though he had served in the Senate since 1938, he looked more like a banker than a politician. He wore rimless spectacles and, like Harry Truman, his hat at dead center. His Cheshire Cat grin was famous. Often tactless, habitually brusque with those less intelligent than he, Taft was a poor mixer, a poor public speaker. He had trouble remembering names. His reputation for hard work and standing by principle, however, his fund of knowledge and ability to cut to the heart of an issue, were considered second to none in the Senate. He was Mr. Republican, incorruptible, extremely conservative, and, unlike Vandenberg, a confirmed isolationist. But he could also be highly independent and exasperate the old guard of his party by advocating such liberal programs as federal aid to education, health, and housing. Senator Wallace H. White of Maine, a quiet, colorless figure, was to be the Republican majority leader in name only. Taft would be the one running things. Taft, Vandenberg, and Martin were all determined to restore Congress to the prestige and authority that had been lost during the Roosevelt era. Martin would insist in his first address as Speaker, "Our American concept of government rests upon the idea of a dominant Congress." All three men, furthermore, were considered presidential prospects for 1948, and Taft in particular. Determined to follow in his father's footsteps, Taft had already tried for the Republican nomination in 1940. Now, with Harry Truman in office, his opportunity looked greater than ever. Nor, importantly, was Taft interested in cooperating with the administration. "The purpose of the opposition is to oppose," he was fond of saying. And unlike Vandenberg and Martin, he had little regard for Truman, who, to Taft, was truly an ordinary man, deficient in background and education, ill-equipped in nearly every way for so heavy a responsibility, in addition to being overly susceptible to the bad advice of liberals. Among the new faces in Republican ranks in the 80th Congress were Representative Richard M. Nixon of California, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. of Massachusetts, and Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. Among the relative handful of new Democrats elected was Representative John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts, the 29-year-old son of Joe Kennedy. For all the labor strife of the year before, the country was prospering as it never had, just as Truman declared in his State of the Union message on January 6, 1947. Food production was at a new high. The national income was higher than ever before in peacetime. "We have virtually full employment," he said with satisfaction. He looked like a man befitting the message, healthy and purposeful. At 7 that morning, he had walked from the White House to Union Station to meet the train from Missouri bringing Bess and Margaret, who sat now listening in the gallery. He called for far-ranging improvements in labor-management relations, a strengthening of the antitrust laws, a national health insurance program, including support for mental health, child care, and hospital construction. He wanted a fair level of return for farmers, aid to veterans, an aggressive program of home construction. He promised new progress in civil rights. In no way was the speech a retreat from the domestic programs he had set forth in his message of 1945. Yet the tone was different, more reasonable, more optimistic. He advocated a balanced budget, a streamlining of the military establishment, international control of atomic energy. He ended with what would later seem a prescient line about sharing America's bounty with the war-stricken peoples over the world. Also, notably missing this time, was any mention of Franklin Roosevelt. Written in large part by Clark Clifford, with help from George Elsie, who, like Clifford, was in naval uniform no longer, but serving as Clifford's assistant, the speech went far to raise Truman's standing with Congress. Even greater was the effect of the surprise announcement he made at the White House the following evening. George C. Marshall was to be the new Secretary of State. Jimmy Burns had resigned. Marshall was already en route from China. The appointment of Marshall was one of the best, most important decisions of Truman's presidency. One wonders, as Truman must have in later years, how differently history might have unfolded had Marshall declined to serve as Secretary of State at that particular moment in world affairs. The reaction everywhere was immediate, virtually unanimous approval. Henry Stimson might have been speaking for the whole nation when he wrote to Marshall, "Your appointment as Secretary of State has filled me with a great sense of security so far as our country is concerned. Mr. Truman made a wise as well as a very shrewd appointment." On Capitol Hill, Arthur Vandenberg pushed the nomination through the Foreign Relations Committee without a hearing or opposition, and by calling for a suspension of the rules, ran it through the Senate for unanimous approval the same day. The one possible shadow on the appointment, in the view of some Republicans, was the chance that it might set Marshall up as a future candidate for president, an idea Marshall himself put to rest the same morning he arrived in Washington. He would never be a candidate for any political office, he said. And being Marshall, he was taken at his word. He was sworn in at the White House by Chief Justice Vinson later that morning, Tuesday, January 21st, 1947. When a beaming Truman shook his hand and said how much he appreciated Marshall's willingness to accept this burden, Marshall replied simply that he would do his best. At 66, George C. Marshall was the first career soldier to become Secretary of State. He had been born on the last day of 1880 in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh, where through boyhood, from his businessman father, he heard repeated accounts of his distinguished Virginia ancestry, including the distantly related John Marshall, the great Chief Justice. "I thought that the continuing harping on the name John Marshall was kind of poor business," he later said. "It was about time for somebody else to swim for the family." Graduated from the Virginia Military Institute in 1901, he was commissioned a second lieutenant in the infantry and advanced steadily thereafter, serving in the Philippines, Oklahoma Territory, and Fort Leavenworth, until World War I, when, as Pershing's aide, he directed the American advance to the Argonne. Between the wars, he had served 3 years in China. In 1939, Roosevelt made him chief of staff. He was slightly under 6 feet tall, with sandy gray, close-cropped hair, and light blue eyes. His long face, with its long upper lip, had a homespun fatherly quality, and often in repose he looked quite sad. With age, his shoulders had begun to stoop slightly. As Dean Acheson would write, there was little military glamour about him, nothing pretentious. Rather, it was an intangible aura that affected people. Like George Washington, with whom he was often compared, Marshall was a figure of such flawless rectitude and self-command, he both inspired awe and made description difficult. Churchill called him the noblest Roman. Bill Hassett, on Truman's staff, spoke of the reverence Marshall inspired. Imperturbable under pressure, the imperturbability of a good conscience, George Kennan called it, invariably courteous, he was without a trace of petty vanity or self-serving ambition. As one of his staff at the State Department later wrote, Marshall did not possess the intellectual brilliance of someone like Acheson or the gift of eloquence, but he could distinguish what was important from what was unimportant, and this made him invaluable. Acheson liked to recall in later years that the moment Marshall entered a room, one could feel his presence. It was a striking and commanding force. His figure conveyed intensity, which his voice, low, staccato, and incisive, reinforced. It compelled respect. It spread a sense of authority and calm. At the Pentagon, some lower-ranking officers had been known to exit from Marshall's office backwards, and no one of any rank, not even the president, called him George. Only General Marshall. A title, as Acheson said, that suited him as though he had been baptized with it. Once, reportedly, when Roosevelt had called him George, he responded, "It's General Marshall, Mr. President." Truman described Marshall as astute, profound, and more of a listener than a talker. "He never made any speeches at you," Truman would gratefully recall. Sometimes he would sit for an hour with little or no expression on his face, but when he had heard enough, he would come up with a statement of his own that would invariably cut to the very bone of the matter under discussion. But it was Marshall's rock-bound sense of duty, his selflessness and honesty, that Truman especially prized. He was a man you could count on to be truthful in every way. And when you find somebody like that, you have to hang on to them. As Truman the politician also appreciated, Marshall stood high with Republicans on the Hill in a way almost no one else did. And this, irrespective of the fact that he had worked so closely through the war with the Democrat they all liked least, Franklin Roosevelt. It had been Marshall who got the first peacetime draft past Congress. Marshall who had confided the secret of the atomic bomb to the congressional leadership, trusting them to keep the secret. For Marshall, his recent mission to China had been a heavy disappointment. Trying to mediate a peace between the two Chinas of the nationalist Kuomintang government under Chiang Kai-shek and the communists of Mao Zedong, he had achieved only a tentative ceasefire. "I hate failure," he told a friend. But failure was what he had had to announce on the eve of his departure from China. "On the one hand, the leaders of the government are strongly opposed to a communistic form of government," he reported. "On the other, the communists frankly state that they are Marxists and intend to work toward establishing a communistic form of government in China." His efforts with the Kuomintang had been frustrating in the extreme. It was a government riddled with corruption, overburdened with too many generals. "Though I speak as a soldier, I must deplore the dominating influence of the military." But the communists fostered only chaos and violent anti-American propaganda, and with more than a million men under arms, their power was gaining. Marshall had failed in his mission to China, yet No one blamed him for the failure. Such was the scale of the problem and his own reputation. No one looked on his new assignment as anything but a very large step forward for the troubled Truman administration. Marshall assumed his new duties at once, and at once the difference was felt. Jimmy Burns had been a hard-working Secretary of State, and more effective than generally acknowledged, or than Truman would portray him in his later reflections. But Burns had been maddeningly independent, determined to do everything himself, and continuously, incurably on the move. In 546 days as secretary, Burns had been away 241, and had shown little interest in the department itself. Under Marshall, all that changed. He gave a sense of purpose and direction. His personality infected the whole Foreign Service, Bolin remembered. There was greater clarity in the operation than I had ever seen before. And Marshall never forgot, as Burns did, that Truman was president. With Truman's blessing, a new policy planning staff was established under the brilliant George Kennan, who had been recalled from Moscow. Organization overall was made more orderly and efficient. When section heads fell into dispute in his presence, Marshall would tell them, "Gentlemen, don't fight the problem. Solve it." Acheson, who had wished to return to private life, was persuaded to stay on as undersecretary for another 6 months. Acheson found working with the general such a joy, wrote David Lilienthal after a dinner at Acheson's Georgetown home, that he could hardly talk about anything else. Marshall, like Truman, was decisive. When Acheson informed Marshall that the State Department had outgrown its quarters in the old Victorian structure beside the White House, and that a new building was available near the Potomac in the section called Foggy Bottom, Marshall said, "Move." To no one was Marshall's presence more assuring or inspiriting than to Truman. "The more I see and talk to him, the more certain I am he's the great one of the age," Truman wrote not long after Marshall's swearing in. "Marshall is a tower of strength and common sense," he noted privately another time. It was admiration such as Truman felt for no other public figure, no one he had ever known, not Roosevelt, not Churchill, not anyone. Nor was he at all hesitant or concerned over having such a strong-minded man as his Secretary of State. Marshall, Harriman, Patterson, Forrestal, Lilienthal, Eisenhower, they were all strong-minded. Conceivably, Truman could have worried that someone of such immense reputation as Marshall in so prominent a role would diminish his own standing with the country, that he might suffer by comparison, and Marshall be perceived as more the sort of man who ought to be president. But Truman was neither jealous nor intimidated. He was not so constructed. "I am surely lucky to have his friendship and support," he wrote. And that was that. By early February 1947, White House reporters were commenting on the president's greater ease and relaxation. "He no longer moans to every visitor that he doesn't want the job and never did," wrote Joseph Alsop to a friend. After a social call on the president, the former heavyweight boxing champion, Gene Tunney, said he had never seen a more solid citizen. "His eye is clear, and he is just as solid as a wall. His jaw is square, and his stomach is just as flat as an athlete's." Truman's popularity in the polls, due in large measure to Marshall's presence, was back up to 48%. The whole atmosphere was different. Truman had opened the White House to sightseers again after a 6-year wartime ban on all but official callers. He and Bess reinstated formal receptions and state dinners for the first time since 1941. And the contrast between the Trumans at home in their private quarters and their official social life was amazing. The president, with his sense of history, wanted White House entertaining done just so, done to the minute, by rules that had not changed in half a century except in wartime. They brought back all the pageantry, assistant head usher J.B. West remembered approvingly, all the formality, all the pomp that we had all but forgotten how to execute. We, the White House staff, had to work out the details, so that all the president and his wife had to do was to be in the right place at the right time. For a reception, they'd march down the stairs to the Blue Room and receive the guests and then march back upstairs. But behind the scenes, we spent weeks of preparation and scheduling for each detail of that right place and right time. Attendance at the first reception, to honor the Supreme Court on December 10th, had been 1,333. Dress was white tie. The Marine Band played. The papers say today that Bess and I have shaken hands with 7,000 people this season, Truman wrote to his mother on February 9th. At a full-dress affair for Senator Vandenberg in the state dining room, the gold service was used. The night of the diplomatic reception again more than 1,000 attended. Before the war, only about 500 people in total had been accredited to the embassies and legations in Washington. For one occasion, Truman asked Eugene List, the concert pianist, to perform for the customers. And again, as at Potsdam, List played the president's favorite Chopin waltz in A minor, but this time without the president's help as page-turner. "I was somewhat nervous through the entertainment," Truman told his mother, "because Mr. Krim, the usher, and Jim Rowley of the Secret Service came and told me that the engineers had found that the chain holding the center chandelier was stretching. I let the show go and ordered the thing down the next day. If it had fallen, I'd been in a real fix." Truman was glad to see Lent arrive and put an end to such affairs, he told his mother. He was tired of smirking at people I don't like. On February 19th, in another letter to Grandview, he could report that the season was over. Thank goodness. But the truth was he had had a fine time every time. J.B. West would remember that, despite all the denying in the world, which he did, we could see the president enjoyed it. He was an extrovert, a friendly man. And he liked company. Hearings on the Lilienthal nomination were causing a sensation, meanwhile, with Senator Kenneth McKellar insisting TVA was a hotbed of communism and that David E. Lilienthal was more than a little suspect. The senator thought it was General Groves who had discovered the secret of splitting the atom, and failed to understand why Groves should not therefore be left in command of his discovery. Looking down from the bench, the senator asked Lilienthal where his parents had been born. When Lilienthal was unable to answer with certainty, McKellar acted as though he had scored an important point. He pressed the issue again another day. This time, Lilienthal said he had been able to determine only that it had been in Austro-Hungary, somewhere near Pressburg, in what had since become Czechoslovakia. Again, McKellar smiled at the audience as if everything were going his way, Czechoslovakia being under Soviet influence. But when he turned and abruptly asked Lilienthal to explain his views on the communistic doctrine, the answer Lilienthal gave held the room spellbound. With his hands folded on the table in front of him, Lilienthal spoke for several minutes, his eyes not on McKellar or the committee, but on a spot somewhere just above his hands, almost as though he were talking to himself. He had felt a kind of smoldering within, he later wrote, far from anger or temper, but some emotional tempo quite different, but definitely emotional. As he talked, he kept saying to himself, "Don't deny, affirm." "I believe in," he said, "and I conceive the Constitution of the United States to rest, as does religion, upon the fundamental proposition of the integrity of the individual, and that all government and all private institutions must be designed to promote and protect and defend the integrity and the dignity of the individual. Any forms of government, therefore, and any other institutions, which make men means rather than ends in themselves, which exalt that state or any other institutions above the importance of men, which place arbitrary power over men as a fundamental tenet of government, are contrary to this conception, and therefore I am deeply opposed to them. The fundamental tenet of communism is that the state is an end in itself, and that therefore the powers which the state exercises over the individual are without any ethical standards to limit them. That I deeply disbelieve. It is very easy simply to say one is not a communist. And, of course, if, despite my record, it is necessary for me to state this very affirmatively, then this is a great disappointment to me. It is very easy to talk about being against communism. It is equally important to believe those things which provide a satisfactory and effective alternative. Democracy is that satisfying alternative. And its hope in the world is that it is an affirmative belief, rather than simply a belief against something else. I deeply believe in the capacity of democracy to surmount any trials that may lie ahead, provided only we practice it in our daily lives. And among the things that we must practice is this, that while we seek fervently to ferret out the subversive and anti-democratic forces in the country, we do not at the same time, by hysteria, by resort to innuendo and sneers and other unfortunate tactics, besmirch the very cause that we believe in, and cause a separation among our people, cause one group and one individual to hate one another, based upon mere attacks, mere unsubstantiated attacks upon their loyalty. Hearsay and gossip had no place in courts of justice. If the principles of protection of an individual and his good name against gossip and hearsay were not upheld by legislatures in their investigating activities, that too would be a failure of the democratic ideal. Then, pausing, he unfolded his hands and said, "This I deeply believe." For a moment, the room was silent. Then, almost in a rush, members of the committee and people from the audience began crowding around him to praise Lilienthal for what he had said. From the White House, Truman let Lilienthal know that he would not only stand behind the nomination, but was in the fight with all he had, if it took 150 years. In the days following, a strain of anti-Semitism in the opposition to the appointment became increasingly apparent. Then, without warning, and without waiting for the committee report to reach the floor, Senator Taft announced he would oppose the nomination on the grounds that Lilienthal was not only a typical power-hungry bureaucrat and temperamentally unfitted for the job of heading the Atomic Energy Commission, but soft on the subject of communism. Until this point, it had been McKellar's show, and thus largely personal and predictable. In earlier days, the senator had seen communists behind the anti-poll tax bill, too. But now, with Mr. Republican stepping in, it became a distinctly partisan issue, and, as was said, a major capital crisis. The phrase, soft on communism, caught on immediately. Lilienthal did not see how he could possibly win with the Republican majority lined up against him. The Taft speech had been a kick in the teeth. How long the confirming process might take, and at what toll, no one could say. Courage. What is it? Lilienthal asked in his diary. Isn't it the capacity to hang on? Section 2. He had been trying for days to find time to write to her, Truman told his sister in a letter in February. He was more concerned than usual about staying in touch. Mama had had a fall and fractured her hip. Truman had flown home to see her, but remained gravely worried, and concerned, too, about the burden of care on Mary Jane. Now, Mary, don't you work too hard. If she needed help, she was to get it. Things have been happening here in a hurry, he told her. Foreign affairs were uppermost. Marshall was to leave for Moscow in little more than a week for his first foreign ministers' conference. He himself would be flying to Mexico in 3 days for the first visit to Mexico ever by a president of the United States. I am spending every day with Marshall going over policy and hoping we can get a lasting peace. It looks not so good right now. The date was February 27th, 1947. 6 days earlier, on the 21st, a month to the day since Marshall took up his duties as Secretary of State, an urgent formal message, a so-called blue paper, from the British ambassador, Lord Inverchapel, had been delivered to the State Department. Marshall had been out of town, speaking at Princeton University's bicentennial convocation. So it was Undersecretary Acheson who telephoned Truman that afternoon. Great Britain, its financial condition worsening, could no longer provide economic and military support for Greece and Turkey. The cost was too great. The Attlee government would withdraw 40,000 troops from Greece and all economic aid would halt as of March 31st. The United States, it was hoped, would assume the responsibility. The news was both momentous and not wholly unexpected. Britain was in desperate straits. All Europe had been hit by one of the worst winters on record. In France, the cold destroyed millions of acres of winter wheat. Snow fell in Paris for the first time in years. In Berlin, where temperatures hovered around zero, people were dying of the cold. Ice clogged the Kiel Canal from the Baltic to the North Sea. Food and fuel were scarce everywhere. In Prague, electric current was being shut off for 3 hours a day. But Britain was hit hardest, the whole country virtually snowbound. Factories and schools closed. Huge snowdrifts blocked highways and railroads, closed coal mines, and isolated hundreds of small towns. When a bus on a main coastal road ran into a 10-foot drift and a snowplow was brought to the rescue, reported the Times of London, the snowplow, too, was buried. Weather threatens coal supply, read the headline in the Times on February 6th. To save power, London offices were being lit with candles. And the storms continued. On February 21st, the day of Lord Inverchapel's message, it snowed again over most of the country. On January 20th, meantime, the British government had issued an economic white paper describing Britain's position as extremely serious. That Britain would soon have to cut back on its armed forces and overseas commitments was self-evident. The situation, wrote Walter Lippmann, would shake the world and make our position highly vulnerable and precariously isolated. Specific warnings had been crossing Truman's desk for weeks. As early as February 3rd, the American ambassador in Athens, Lincoln McVeigh, reported rumors that the British were pulling out of Greece, where, since 1945, their troops and money had helped maintain a royalist government in a raging civil war with communist guerrillas. On February 12th, another dispatch from McVeigh urged immediate consideration of American aid to Greece. A few days later, Mark Etheridge, publisher of the Louisville Courier-Journal and a member of a United Nations investigating committee, cabled from Athens that Greece was a ripe plum ready to fall into Soviet hands. Warnings about Turkey had come even sooner. Turkey had little hope of independent survival unless it is assured of solid, long-term American and British support, cabled General Walter Bedell Smith, who had replaced Averell Harriman as the American ambassador in Moscow. Truman himself, furthermore, had already made his concern for the future of Greece clear to the Greek government, if not as yet to the American people. In the fall of 1946, through Ambassador McVeigh, Truman had acknowledged that Greece was of vital interest to the United States and promised substantial aid to maintain its independence, providing the Greek government could show that democracy survived there, a question of considerable importance since the Greek government, as Truman knew and later wrote, seemed to encourage irresponsible rightist groups. But while the crisis in Greece and Turkey came not without warning, the formal announcement of British withdrawal did come, as Truman said, sooner than we expected, and its very formality made it seem especially dramatic and unsettling. February 21st was a Friday. Truman asked Acheson for a report by Monday, and Acheson, Bolin, and others worked through the weekend at the old State Department, where packing boxes cluttered the halls in preparation for the move to Foggy Bottom. On Monday, Marshall and Acheson met with the president and urged immediate action to provide help for Greece and, to a lesser degree, for Turkey as well. To Marshall, the British announcement of withdrawal from Greece was tantamount to British withdrawal from the whole Middle East. He, too, saw the situation as extremely serious. The sum needed for Greece alone, just for the remainder of 1947, was $250 million. Truman agreed. Greece would have to be helped, quickly and with substantial amounts. But aid to Greece was only one aspect of the problem. It had been a year now since Canaan's long telegram and Churchill's Iron Curtain speech at Fulton. Something more than a simple aid bill was called for. On this, Truman, Marshall, Acheson, Clifford, virtually all who had a say in policy, were agreed. One ranking State Department official, Joseph M. Jones, urged that Secretary Marshall, not the president, go before Congress to rouse the nation to the reality of the crisis. Because, as Jones wrote in an internal memorandum, Marshall was the only one in government with the prestige to make a deep impression. Things were, indeed, happening in a hurry, as Truman told his sister. The morning of the 27th, he called the congressional leaders to his office for a crucial meeting. They listened first to Marshall, who, in measured tones, told them, "It is not alarmist to say that we are faced with the first crisis of a series which might extend Soviet domination to Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. The choice was acting with energy or losing by default." Acheson, who thought Marshall had failed to speak with appropriate force, asked to be heard. There was no time left for a measured appraisal, Acheson said. Greece was the rotten apple that would infect the whole barrel. The Soviet Union was playing one of the greatest gambles in history at minimal cost. It did not need to win all the possibilities. When Acheson finished, according to his own later account, Vandenberg told the president in a sonorous manner that if he would say the same thing in the same way to Congress, then he, Vandenberg, would lend his support and so would a majority on Capitol Hill. His clear implication being that aid to Greece and Turkey could be had only if Truman shocked Congress into action. But in his memoirs, for all his regard for Acheson, Truman would make no mention of Acheson's remarks or the Vandenberg response as described by Acheson. Truman said only that Marshall had made it quite plain that the choice was to act or lose by default. And I expressed my emphatic agreement to this. The meeting ended at noon. Nothing was disclosed of what had been said. The crowds in Mexico City were such as Truman had never experienced. Hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets to see and cheer an American president for the first time. The trip had been Truman's idea, and the acclaim was thrilling. He returned the vivas of the throngs, one woman shouted, "Viva Missouri," and several times broke away from his Mexican and Secret Service escorts to shake hands with people. "I have never had such a welcome in my life," he told the Mexican legislature, to whom he pledged anew Roosevelt's good neighbor policy. To a crowd of American citizens later, he said he hoped they would remember that they, too, were ambassadors. The next morning, he announced suddenly that he wished to make an unscheduled stop at Mexico City's historic Chapultepec Castle, where, with one simple, unheralded gesture, he did more to improve Mexican-American relations than had any president in a century. Within hours, as the word spread, he had become a hero. The long motorcade pulled into the shade of an ancient grove of trees. Truman stepped out of his black Lincoln and walked to a stone monument bearing the names of Los Niños Héroes, the child heroes, six teenage cadets who had died in the Mexican-American War in 1847, when American troops stormed the castle. According to legend, five of the cadets had stabbed themselves, and a sixth jumped to his death from a parapet rather than surrender. As Truman approached, a contingent of blue-uniformed Mexican cadets stood at attention. As he placed a floral wreath at the foot of the monument, several of the cadets wept silently. After bowing his head for a few minutes, Truman returned to the line of cars, where the Mexican chauffeurs were already shaking hands with their American passengers. The story created an immediate sensation in the city, filling the papers with eight-column banner headlines. "Rendering homage to the heroes of 47, Truman heals an old national wound forever," read one. "Friendship began today," said another. A cab driver told an American reporter, "To think that the most powerful man in the world would come and apologize." He wanted to cry himself, the driver said. A prominent Mexican engineer was quoted. 100 years of misunderstanding and bitterness wiped out by one man in 1 minute. This is the best neighbor policy. President Truman, declared Mexican President Miguel Alemán, was the new champion of solidarity and understanding among the American republics. Asked by American reporters why he had gone to the monument, Truman said simply, "Brave men don't belong to any one country. I respect bravery wherever I see it." The three-day whirlwind visit ended on March 6th, when the presidential party departed on the sacred cow before dawn. Moonlight reflected on the plane's wings as Truman looked out the window. Despite the hour and the chill morning air, 1,000 people had come to see him off. Less than a year before, in July 1946, as only a few were aware, Truman had asked Clark Clifford to prepare a comprehensive analysis of Soviet-American relations, the first of its kind. The project began at once, and though Clifford remained in charge, and with his editing gave the finished effort much of its tone and emphasis, the real work, research and writing, was done by his assistant, George Elsey, who had suggested the project in the first place. He had felt, Elsey later explained, that Truman was judging Russia on too narrow a basis, his concerns limited too often to whether or not Russia was keeping its agreements. By the time Elsey was finished in September 1946, the report ran to nearly 100,000 words. It was immensely detailed and clearly influenced by Canaan's long telegram, but most of it had been drawn from interviews with or written reports from a dozen or more key people within the executive branch, including the State and War Departments, and in all, it was a far more alarming state paper than the long telegram, even though, as Elsey himself later said, most of the material had been previously called to Truman's attention by Burns, Forrestal, Harriman, Leahy, and even Harry Hopkins as early as April 1945. Titled American Relations with the Soviet Union, it began by stating that such relations posed the gravest problem facing the United States, and that Soviet leaders appeared to be on a course of aggrandizement designed to lead to eventual world domination by the USSR. The Soviet Union was consistently opposed to British-American efforts to achieve world peace agreements because the longer peace settlements were postponed, the longer Red Army troops could legally remain in enemy countries. Moreover, the Soviets were maintaining excessively large military forces in the satellite countries. The Soviets already dominated Finland, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria. In Austria, only the presence of British, French, and American occupation troops prevented a Soviet takeover. Communist parties were growing in France and Italy. In a weak and divided China, the USSR was in a position to exert greater influence there than any other country. The Soviets were supplying the communist forces in China, while in Korea, the Soviets had shown that they would consent to the unification of the country only if assured of a friendly government. Most ominous was Soviet military power. Generalissimo Stalin and his associates are supporting armed forces stronger than those of any potential combination of foreign powers, and they are developing as rapidly as possible a powerful and self-sufficient economy. They are seizing every opportunity to expand the area, directly or indirectly, under Soviet control in order to provide additional protection for the vital areas of the Soviet Union. The menace was gathering. Russia was rapidly developing atomic weapons, guided missiles, materials for biological warfare, a strategic air force, submarines of great cruising range. The Soviet Union, the grim report continued, was also actively directing espionage and subversive movements in the United States. Since the language of military power was the only language the Russians understood, it was necessary that the United States maintain sufficient military strength to confine Soviet influence. Therefore, the United States, too, must be prepared to wage atomic and biological warfare. The mere fact of preparedness may be the only powerful deterrent to Soviet aggressive action, and in this sense, the only sure guarantee of peace. In reviewing the situation in the Middle East, the report noted that the Soviets hoped for the withdrawal of troops from Greece to establish another of their friendly governments there. The Soviet desire for Turkey was a puppet state to serve as a springboard for the domination of the Eastern Mediterranean. Finally, the report concluded that, in addition to maintaining its military strength, the United States should support and assist all democratic countries which are in any way menaced or endangered by the USSR. George Kennan, when asked to look at a nearly completed draft, judged it excellent. Truman, who was up much of one night reading the final report, called Clifford at his home early the next morning to ask how many copies there were. 10, Clifford said. Truman wanted the other 9 put immediately under lock and key. The report was so hot, he told Clifford, that if it ever came out, its effect on his efforts to resolve the East-West conflict peacefully would be exceedingly unfortunate. How much effect it had on Truman is difficult to gauge. He never said. Clifford, when recounting the Truman years, would stress its great far-reaching influence, while Elsie would be far more modest. The impact of having it all drawn together may have had some influence on the president, Elsie would speculate. Again, I don't think one can. You never know, and neither the president nor anyone else is ever able to say exactly what all the influences are that help make up his mind. All the same, it was Clifford and Elsie who, after Truman's return from Mexico, put the finishing touches to the historic speech Truman would make before Congress concerning the situation in Greece, and much that was in the speech came directly from the report. At a cabinet meeting on March 7th, Truman's first day back from Mexico, Acheson said the complete disintegration of Greece was only weeks away. If we go in, we cannot be certain of success in the Middle East and Mediterranean. If we do not go in, there will be a collapse in these areas. There was also, of course, the possibility of military risk. Truman felt he faced a decision as difficult as any ever to confront a president. The money for Greece was only the beginning. It means the United States is going into European politics. The president's staff viewed the speech as potentially the most important of his career. A first draft had been prepared at the State Department, but Truman thought it too wordy and technical, more like an investment prospectus, as he later wrote. He also wanted the addition of a strong statement of American policy. Acheson made cuts and revisions, modified several passages, including a key sentence that essentially repeated what had been in the Clifford Elsie report about helping countries in jeopardy from the Soviet Union, only here the Soviet Union was not to be mentioned by name. It is the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures, the line read in its original state. Acheson changed it to, I believe it must be the policy of the United States. To Clifford, it was time to take a stand against the Soviets. Time for the opening gun in a campaign to awaken the American people. As he had urged the president to stand fast against John L. Lewis, so Clifford now urged a strong response to Stalin. George Kennan, on the other hand, thought the speech went too far. And in Paris, Marshall looked it over with Chip Bohlen, who was accompanying him to Moscow, and both felt there was too much rhetoric. When Bernard Baruch, who had no official position in the administration, let it be known that he, too, wished to have a say in the matter, Truman refused. "If you take his advice," Truman said, "then you have him on your hands for hours and hours, and it is his policy. I'm just not going to do it. We have a decision to make, and we'll make it." Hearing the story later from Clifford, David Lilienthal wrote in his diary that, "The president's comment interested me because it was so human. One of the few things a president can enjoy is to decide whom he will consult." Truman had Clifford and Elsie finish up the final draft as suited him. He was no Woodrow Wilson who could sit down at a typewriter the night before addressing Congress at an historic juncture and tap out his own speech. But he knew what he wanted. "I wanted no hedging. It had to be clear and free of hesitation or double talk." In answer to Marshall's concern about rhetoric, Marshall was told that in the opinion of the executive branch, including the president, the Senate would not approve the new policy without emphasis on the communist threat. Probably that was correct. "There is, you know, such a thing as being too intellectual in your approach to a problem," Clark Clifford would say years later in an interview. "The man who insists on seeing all sides of it often can't make up his mind where to take hold." Without any disparagement, that was never a problem for Mr. Truman. He wanted all the facts he could get before he made up his mind. But if he could get only 80% of the facts in the time available, he didn't let the missing 20% tie him up in indecision. He believed that even a wrong decision was better than no decision at all. And when he made up his mind, that was it. We'd been through the greatest war in which the world had ever been involved. This is 1947. The war ended in August of 1945. There was every reason for Harry Truman to say, "This is not for us." And he kept worrying about it, thinking about it. I remember thinking there was really nothing to impede the Soviet forces, if they chose to, from just marching straight west to the English Channel. And yet, he decided that it had to be done. Harry Truman looks at this, and he just steps up to it. The speech setting forth what became known as the Truman Doctrine was delivered in the House chamber before a joint session of Congress on Wednesday, March 12, 1947, beginning a few minutes past 1 o'clock. It was a straightforward declarative statement lasting 18 minutes. Greece was in desperate need. The situation was urgent. The existing Greek government was not perfect, and the government of the United States, no less than ever, condemned extremist measures of the right or left. Though Turkey, unlike Greece, had been spared the destruction and suffering of the war, Turkey also needed American support. One of the primary objectives of American policy, Truman said, was the creation of conditions in which we and other nations will be able to work out a way of life free of coercion. This had been a fundamental issue in the war with Germany and Japan, countries that had tried to impose their will and their way of life upon other countries. Dressed in a dark suit and dark tie, he read from an open notebook slowly and with great force. His audience listened in silence. Hardly anyone moved. In the front row, John Snyder had his head bowed. Beside him, the perfectly tailored Acheson sat as stiff and straight as if at a memorial service, hands folded in his lap. Further along in the same row, Senator Taft fiddled with his glasses, rubbed his face, then yawned. On the dais behind Truman, Speaker Martin and Senator Vandenberg were following the speech line by line in printed copies. "At the present moment in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life. The choice is too often not a free one. One way of life is based upon the will of the majority and is distinguished by free institutions, representative government, free elections, guarantees of individual liberty, freedom of speech and religion, and freedom from political oppression. The second way of life is based upon the will of a minority forcibly imposed upon the majority. It relies upon terror and oppression, a controlled press and radio, fixed elections, and the suppression of personal freedoms. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. I believe that we must assist free peoples to work out their own destinies in their own way. I believe that our help should be primarily through economic and financial aid, which is essential to economic stability and orderly political processes. Should we fail to aid Greece and Turkey in this fateful hour, the effect will be far-reaching to the West as well as to the East. We must take immediate and resolute action. To many who were listening there in the chamber and over the radio, it seemed an odd, ironic time for a crisis. The United States was the richest, strongest country in the world and prospering as few could have ever imagined. Production was up. Incomes were up. There were few strikes. There was no more waiting for new automobiles, no meat shortages any longer. White shirts, nylon stockings, fishing tackle, and golf balls were back on store shelves. Because of the GI Bill, more than 4 million veterans were attending college, as most never could have in other times. Yet the speech seemed disturbingly like a call to arms. "Well, I told my wife to dust off my uniform," an ex-soldier enrolled at the University of Oklahoma remarked to a reporter. The cost of winning the war had been $341 billion. Now, $400 million was needed for Greece and Turkey. "This is a serious course upon which we embark," Truman said at the finish, and the look on his face was serious indeed. "I would not recommend it, except that the alternative is much more serious. If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of this nation." The entire room rose in applause. But as Acheson later wrote, it was more as a tribute to a brave man than a unanimous acceptance of his policy. Truman, holding the closed notebook with the speech in front of his chest with both hands, nodded to the applause left and right several times, but he never smiled. Editorial reaction was overwhelmingly supportive. The New York Times compared the speech to the Monroe Doctrine. To the editors of Time and Life, it was a great clearing of the air at long last. "Like a bolt of lightning," said Life, "the speech cut through the confused international atmosphere." The president, said Collier's, had hit the popularity jackpot. But support was often expressed with troubling reservations. "Are we to shoulder the mantle of 19th-century British imperialism?" asked the San Francisco Examiner. And some of the liberal press was outraged. PM charged Truman with scrapping Roosevelt's whole policy on Russia. Most important was the objection of Walter Lippmann, who, though favoring aid to Greece, disapproved of the president's tone. "A vague global policy which sounds like the tocsin of an ideological crusade has no limits," Lippmann warned. "It cannot be controlled. Its effects cannot be predicted." That the speech was of immense importance, signaling a turning point, no one seems to have doubted. If words could shape the future of nations, wrote Newsweek, these unquestionably would. They had clearly put America into power politics to stay. On Capitol Hill, Senator Vandenberg was quick to stress that he did not consider Greek-Turkish aid as a universal pattern, but something only to fit a given circumstance. Acheson, too, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the bill was not intended to establish a pattern for the future. The United States, he stressed, would, of course, act according to the circumstances of each specific case. Objections in Congress came from liberals and conservatives alike. Senator Pepper was sure such a policy would destroy all hope of reconciliation with Russia. Senators Byrd and McKellar were opposed chiefly because of cost. "I guess the do-gooders won't feel right until they have us all broke," said Republican Representative Harold Knutson of Minnesota. Truman, within minutes after delivering the speech, had been on his way to the airport and another flight to Florida. The president, explained Wallace Graham, had been going pretty hard lately and needed a rest. In plain truth, the president was exhausted. Writing to Margaret from Key West, he said no one had any idea how worn to a frazzle he was by this terrible decision. But the police state of communism was no different from the police state of the Nazis, he told her. He had known that since Potsdam. In the time between Truman's dramatic appearance before Congress and the final vote on aid to Greece and Turkey, the fight in the Senate over the Lilienthal nomination grew intense and abusive. The opposition was nearly all Republican. Senator John Bricker of Ohio, who had been Dewey's running mate in 1944, warned that it might be the last chance ever to get the Atomic Energy Commission out of the hands of leftists. Capehart of Indiana said that especially now, in view of the situation in Greece and Turkey, control of atomic energy ought to be returned to the Army, an idea that appealed also to Senator Taft. Brewster of Maine, who had once served on the Truman Committee, claimed Lilienthal's indifference to communism made him no less a threat than if he were an outright party member. "If Mr. L. is a communist, so am I," Truman wrote privately. He would carry the fight to the end, Truman vowed. "It is a matter of principle, and we cannot let the peanut politicians ruin a good man." Taft, Truman thought, was succeeding only in making himself look like a fool. A few Republicans, Noland of California, Saltonstall of Massachusetts, Aiken of Vermont, declared support for the nominee. But the decisive moment came when Vandenberg spoke to a tense session on the afternoon of April 3rd, giving what many thought was his finest speech ever. "David Lilienthal," Vandenberg said, "was no part of a communist by any stretch of the imagination." When Vandenberg called for Lilienthal's confirmation, the galleries roared with applause. There was a test vote on an amendment. Lilienthal was with Truman at the White House when Charlie Ross put his head in at the door to report the result. They had won by a margin of 14 votes, more than anyone had thought possible. Truman and Lilienthal shook hands. "Atomic energy was the most important thing there is," Truman remarked, looking subdued and thoughtful. "You must make a blessing of it, or," he said, pointing to a large globe in the corner, "we'll blow that all to smithereens." The final formal vote in the Senate came on April 9th, when a total of 20 Republicans defied Taft to support Lilienthal. Of the Southern Democrats, only 4 besides McKellar voted against him. The nomination was confirmed by 50-31. It was Truman's first test of strength with the new Congress, and a sweet victory. Yet the issue of loyalty, the issue of who was or who was not, in Taft's phrase, soft on communism, was by no means ended. The Republican leadership, having made communism a theme with such success in the fall elections, would keep up the demand for investigations. And Truman, to head off such attacks from conservatives in both parties, had by this time accepted the view of a special commission and of Attorney General Clark and the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, that a program of loyalty reviews was necessary. The whole concept troubled him. In notes he made of a conversation with the president in May 1947, Clark Clifford wrote, "He is very strongly anti-FBI, wants to be sure to hold FBI down, afraid of Gestapo." Further, much too much was being made of the communist bugaboo, Truman thought, and said so in a letter to a former Pennsylvania governor named George Earle. "The country was perfectly safe so far as communism is concerned. We have far too many sane people." The political pressures bore heavily, however. Attorney General Clark, conceding that the number of disloyal employees in the government was probably small, argued that even one such person posed a serious threat. J. Edgar Hoover wanted authority to remove anyone from public service whose views were politically suspect. Such people, Hoover warned, might well influence foreign policy in a way that could favor the foreign country of their ideological choice. Like many Republicans on Capitol Hill, Hoover saw the State Department as the core of the problem. In his first speech as the new Speaker of the House, Joe Martin had declared there was no room in the government of the United States for any who prefer the communistic system. Accusations that the New Deal had been riddled with communists were made repeatedly and widely believed, however unfounded. The long tenure of the Democratic Party had poisoned the air we Republicans breathed, remembered Martin much later. Fear of communist penetration of the government was an ugly new phenomenon. Suspicion of the State Department was rife. We were disturbed and bewildered by the new power of the Soviet Union. Truman worried particularly about the House Committee on Un-American Activities and the extremes it might go to under its vile-tempered and, to Truman, contemptible Republican chairman, Representative J. Parnell Thomas of New Jersey. By acting first on the loyalty issue, Truman hoped to head Thomas off. Also, importantly, he wanted no accusations of administration's softness on communism at home, just as he was calling for a new hard approach to communism abroad.